Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Stephen St. John and Nate Bucati. Now joined by Sam Mellinger in studio with us from the Kansas City Star. Hello, Sam. How are you?
Terrific. How are you?
Doing great. We have a lot to talk about with yous. Yeah. And I'm excited to do it.
Me too.
Would you like to start? So we'll spend the first half hour on one topic, second half hour on the other. What would you like to start with? The Sunflower Showdown or Royals/Chiefs?
Ooh.
What's your mood right now?
This is usually Nate's move, is giving me choose your own adventure on the Border Patrol.
Right.
Let's do Chiefs and Royals first.
Chiefs and Royals first. We will start with the Royals because they had their fan fest over the weekend. I had a chance, and by the way, thank you to everyone who supported, who came out, bought tickets, donated, everyone that was involved with the YMCA's Challenger Fashion event that I emceed. Thank you to Belinda Post from 41 Action News, who's a great co-MC. Thank you to all of the celebrities and all of the people, including our very own Pamela Todd, who runs the promotions department. She was one of the models on the runway, along with Whit Merrifield and Bubba Starling and Jason Hamill. Those guys were all great. And you know how it's set up, Nate. Not only were they there on the runway, but they came out and listened to Dola White and met with fans and took pictures. They were awesome. And the YMCA and our friend Michelle Ford and everyone else that has anything to do with that event should be very proud, because it's one of the best, one of my favorite events every year, and it was great and it was awesome. So thank you on Saturday night. But a lot of people were talking about the Royals because Lorenzo Cain had just signed the day before with the Milwaukee Brewers, and the Royals brought back Alcides Escobar. And so let's just get your reaction to each of those moves, please.
Lorenzo Cain, completely expected that he wouldn't be back. I felt really good for him. My reaction was positive for Lorenzo Cain for a few different reasons. One, I assume that he had good memories and probably some good relationships still with people who might still be in that organization. So good for him to go back to where, you know, the organization that drafted him. But more than that, $80 million. For Lorenzo Cain, which I think is kind of what he's worth. You know, he's a hell of a player, and the way that this market is going, it seems like, you know, guys may start to panic and not be forced, but sign for a little bit less than what, you know, they justifiably should get on the open market. And Lorenzo Cain looked like all these guys that you can't make it to the major leagues without working hard on some level, and you can't make it to a really big sort of generational wealth kind of contract without working really hard. But nobody has ever worked harder than Lorenzo Cain for a big contract like that. I mean, he retaught himself how to run. He learned how to hit basically after he was drafted. I mean, he was super raw, a super raw talent. So I just felt really good for Lorenzo Cain. Alcides Escobar, I don't know. I feel less good about that. You know, it's a short contract. It's not much money, you know, relative, you know, in baseball terms. To me, it means that they don't trust Raul Mondesi. That was my big takeaway on that. They don't trust Raul Mondesi to A, stay healthy, I think, first of all, and B, to be productive at a major league level, the kind of guy that you can throw out there 150 games at shortstop.
What about Nate's suggestion that possibly Mondesi could find himself in the outfield?
So I've wondered about that. That is something that the front office has discussed internally and sort of like subtly publicly, I guess. He's certainly athletic enough to do it. I mean, he's kind of, even, you know, by Major League Baseball standards, kind of a freakish athlete with the arm and the speed. We've learned, you know, if only the Royals had a recent example of a guy who had never played outfield and turned himself into the best of the position, right? So, you know, I think he could do it, but at least at FanFest, I got a different vibe or response from Dayton about that. And it seemed like they're going to play him at short. They've got a lot of bodies that can potentially play center field. You know, they've got a lot of options there. And Raul Mondesi may or may not be better than any of them, but, you know, if you've got a guy like that that can play shortstop, it's tough to move a guy off of shortstop. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's a position that you really, really need to fill. So to me, it was just, you know, it's a sign that they don't trust him completely yet. But one thing that Alcides Escobar can do, and you know, besides swing at the first pitch, one thing that Alcides Escobar can do is play every day. And so I don't think that they need him to play 162 games. I don't think they want him to play 162 games like he has. But as far as like just, I don't know, an insurance or, you know, just a buffer to stop from rushing him, because they rushed Raul Mondesi to the big leagues. That decision to put him at second base over Whit Merrifield just looks worse and worse with each passing day. So if this is a way for them to, you know, make sure that he's ready for the big leagues, you know, this is the optimist view that I'm taking. I understand that. But if this is a way for them to make sure that he's ready for the big leagues, you know, the next time that he stays up in the big leagues, then, you know, that's fine. Decent investment.
Yeah, I think that the philosophy by the Royals is, I talked about this a little bit in 6 o'clock hour with Steven, having talked to so many people in the front office over the years that the Dayton Moore regime has been here, they value shortstops and catchers immensely.
Yes.
And their attitude is, if you can play shortstop slash catcher, you can play a lot of places. And they're the hardest people to find. Mm-hmm. So they're always constantly trying to find more and more. So they feel like they've got a guy who they know can play 162 games at a decent level defensively at shortstop, and sometimes he can hit okay for really cheap. I mean, really cheap with the very little commitment long term. And that gives, I think that their thought process is this gives them options.
Yeah.
They are, look, they're open to the idea of trading Whit Merrifield.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to, because I don't think they're going to get back what they think they need to in order to trade him. But if something comes along, this makes it a little bit easier, because they can say, well, we can put Mondesi at second base if we do that, because we still have Alcides Escobar at short. Or if they decide, you know what, let's give Mondesi a shot in center field. No one else is holding the spot down. Bubba Starling's not ready, and, you know, we don't believe that Orlando's the kind of guy. It gives them the flexibility to do these different types of things for very little commitment. And I think that's the, I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying, sure, I think that's the way they look.
Look, I know it's self-serving, but the Royals can't, they can't lose Hosmer and trade with Merrifield, because then my wife will punch me in the mouth. And so I don't feel like it's in the best interest of really anyone to do both of those things. So let's not get ahead of ourselves here, Nate.
Well, you just talked about the fact that that they don't have a single top 100 prospect.
Right.
They did pick up a draft pick with losing Kane.
And that was the reason why it was significant that his contract was over $50 million.
Yes.
That gets a nice draft pick back for the Royals.
But they need to restock that farm system.
Right.
And so
zero prospects in the top 100 so far released by Baseball America and MLB.com.
Yeah.
They absolutely need to do that. And but one of the things, too, like when you bring up... Did I interrupt you? I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
One of the things about...
I would never interrupt somebody.
Sam, please. Please
do. It's me on this show. No one would interrupt somebody here.
One of the things about when you talk about trading Whit Merrifield, it, you know, my mind immediately goes to when they just... The last trade that they made of, you know, sort of a 0-3 guy making no money, was the Scott Alexander deal. And I understand, like, the baseball logic behind that, but I think they missed an opportunity. They took less in return in order to dump Joaquin Soria's money. And so going forward, if they trade Whit Merrifield, God, I hope it's not just to dump Jason Hamill's money or to dump Ian Kennedy's money or something like, you know, it better be to restock that farm system. It better be so now you have two top 100 prospects, something like that. Because Whit Merrifield, I'm trying to think of how many service years. He's only got one.
Yeah.
I don't think he's got the second year yet. So he's got two more years of making nothing, and then he starts into arbitration. So, you know, that's a valuable piece. And I hope if they do trade him, that you know, the zero top 100 prospects turns into two top 100 prospects.
Yeah, the sense I get is that like I said, they're open to it, but it's going to have to take some real,
totally, yes,
real prospects in return. Because, you know, they could do the same type of thing with Whit Merrifield that they just did with Lorenzo Cain, which is get the prime years out of his career for pennies on the dollar.
Uh-huh.
And then he'll have to go, because he's 29 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time he hits free agency, he's going to be, you know, in his mid-30s. Let's see. It says...
Yeah, he's not going to get a big... He's not going to get the Lorenzo Cain.
He is not free agent eligible until 2023.
Yeah.
He's not arbitration eligible until 2020. So they get two more years before he even hits arbitration. So... That's a, I mean, like you said, they might feel like they're ready to compete even by the time he hits arbitration. One thing I wanted to say about the Mondesi thing too, I know that people know that he's a good athlete, but I don't know that people know, like, he's considered like Jerod Dyson type speed.
Yes.
If not even a little faster than Jerod Dyson. Yeah. So when we talk about the idea of could he go play in center field, I mean, he hasn't really played it at all in his career, but a guy that can run that fast is the kind of guy that you could see turning into like another one of those, you know, Gold Glove caliber type center fielders.
There's
really
no question. Yeah, my pushback on him going to center field, and I absolutely think that it's realistic and he may end up doing it, but my only hesitation is, God, you've got one of these premium positions covered right now, and I think it's harder. They're both really hard to find. But I think it's harder to find a shortstop than a center fielder.
No doubt.
Okay, so let's. You were at FanFest. You talked to some people. Let's get a temperature reading here on some of the other free agents. Now I mentioned Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas. Let me just. We don't know how long we can play that for. You got to keep every chance we get. You got to play Salvador Perez. Jason Vargas, who we never hear anything about, but anything that makes you think that anyone's coming back besides Eski?
I Moustakas.
It really does make me laugh.
It just makes you happy.
It's great.
Is what it is.
There's so much joy in that.
Thank you, my friend.
Nothing that I hear, but some of what there is a path back for Moose, I feel like if Moose resigned, that means that the market really, really, really collapsed on him. The Royals are already planning without him. They've got no intention of signing him. You know, Chesler Cuthbert's going to be their third baseman on opening day, and they're okay with that. They're good with that. They want to see what he can do with regular time. They've been planning on this for at least a year since, you know, Moose's knee injury. And Cuthbert had some nice moments filling in for him there. If he signed back, it just means that the market absolutely collapsed. And not just collapsed, but collapsed to the point where he couldn't even get a short-term deal with the Yankees, which has always been sort of what, after the Angels, I thought the Angels made the most sense. But after that closed up, when they traded for Cozart, the Yankees make a lot of sense for both sides. The Yankees can use that position. I feel like Moose would put up a really big year hitting in that, but not just that ballpark. You know, he's got that pull power that's, you know, it's just a pop fly down the right field line. But that division's got a lot of, you know, Moose friendly ballparks. He could hit 45, you know, maybe even more home runs with a good healthy year,
and maybe get into 3 or 4 verbal altercations per month with the media.
Yes. That would be rough. And, you know, Stephen, you just brought up about Lorenzo Cain. You know, the contract is significant to the Royals because it was $80 million over 50. If that market collapse and you know, 1 year 10 or 1 year 15 or whatever, you know, that is not good for the Royals.
Sam Millinger is in studio. Any other thoughts on FanFest or your discussions with anyone with the Royals?
I thought it was, if you're talking about like just purely baseball stuff,
sure.
I thought Danny Duffy was, I don't know if impressive is the right word, but I mean, he was impressive, but I don't know if that's the right word I'm looking for. He was just, Danny was Danny, I guess. Like he was real. He kind of addressed, you know, like a lot of guys, you ask them a question and they answer the way that they think a baseball player should answer. You know what I mean? Vague and tough and you know, no, that didn't bother me. You asked Andy Duffy a question, and he answers the way that he feels inside, you know, and I feel like there's not really a filter with him. And, you know, I think just hearing so many athletes, you know, go the other route, it's pretty refreshing. And, yeah, I mean, he's real about, you know, there's people who grew up in Kansas City and wear, like, you know, Kansas City hoodies and, you know, hang out in the Crossroads and stuff like that, that don't love Kansas City the way Danny Duffy does. You know what I mean? Like that part of it is extremely real to him. And to hear him talk about sort of seeing his name involved in all these trade rumors. And, you know, if you follow him on Twitter, you know that stuff's getting to him. And if you listen to him talk, you know that stuff's getting to him. And it's cool to hear, you know, some, you know, vulnerability, I guess, from an athlete like that. It was interesting.
Will he be pitching for the Royals in April?
In April, yeah. I think it's a good question, because I think a lot of people assume now that it's just you're done. You know, it's locked and sealed, and it's not. I think he is. You know, I think it's much more likely than not. I think the Royals are absolutely open to trading him. Absolutely, 100% open to trading him. One of the obstacles. I think they feel like they'd be selling low right now. He wasn't as good as he could be last year. He still has a lot left on that contract. Left-handed starting pitching is always going to be in demand. So if he has, you know, if he starts out, you know, 8-1 with a 3.05 ERA, which is entirely possible, maybe not the 8-1 part, but the 3.05 ERA, and he's, you know, near a strikeout an inning and all that stuff, then I think in July they may be able to get some stuff in return for him, for sure, because that's still a club friendly deal. Again, everybody needs left-handed pitching. I mean, that's a valuable piece.
All right, let's hit the Chiefs real quick, and then yeah, we'll spend the rest of the hour talking about college basketball on the Sunflower Showdown. You wrote a very good column over the weekend about Bob Sutton and how deep the problems go. So if you would share with us, we talked about this earlier, and it's just not a pleasant topic right now.
No, it's not.
And you said how you want to be wrong about this.
Oh my gosh. You know, being wrong about this means that Bob Sutton comes back with an opportunity that most coordinators would not expect to come back the year after giving up an 18-point lead at home in a playoff game, the year after being dead effing last in DVOA, the year after, you know, we talk so much about them not being able to stop the run. They couldn't stop the pass either.
Well, now you're nitpicking. So,
you know, right? The year after, I mean, and everybody talks about Eric Berry being injured, and I get it. Like, I love Eric Berry. I think he's legitimately has a chance to be in the Hall of Fame someday. And that was a bad injury. But the year after just being completely exposed for your lack of ability to adjust, the year after, you know, having a terrible defense with Justin Houston healthy the whole year, that doesn't always happen. You know, like the defensive line, like Chris Jones was, I mean, you know, the year after all that, coming back and being able to coordinate a top 10 defense, that would be an incredible story. And it would probably mean that the Chiefs are advancing in the playoffs. That would be amazing. So I do hope that I'm wrong. I don't think that I'm wrong, because, you know, people use that Eric Berry injury as an excuse for Bob Sutton. To me, it's an indictment that you are so dependent on one guy and so incapable of adjusting to an injury that happened in week one, when in the Super Bowl is one team playing with, you know, kind of a freak, you know, the best tight end in football. He gets hurt in the first half of their playoff game. They still win. The Eagles, I mean, the list of injuries that the Eagles had, including
Patriots lost their best defensive player against the Chiefs in week one.
That's true. Absolutely, that's true. And they adjusted fine. Their defense got a hell of a lot better. They finished, what, like fifth in points allowed, something like that? You know, the list of the Eagles' injuries that was supposed to kill them is really long, including the quarterback. To me, it's just an indictment, and I feel like Andy Reid, this is where it gets deeper, because if it was just about, like, you know, you think the coordinator should be fired or not, like, that's just a debate that we can all have, but to me, it goes deeper than that. It goes to Andy Reid, and if the reason to keep him is Andy Reid is loyal, it's just a really bad look, it's a really bad sign for a team that has plateaued for 5 years. And, you know, Andy Reid gets a lot of credit for cleaning up an indescribable mess in a lot of ways. But they've plateaued for 5 years. And he is a coach who historically, through his career, has kind of plateaued. He's in a franchise that historically has had some bottoms, but has plateaued at about where they are right now. And for those two to go forward, no coach has ever won his first Super Bowl this far into his career. No franchise has ever won a second Super Bowl this long after winning the first. And for these two sides to sort of, you know, achieve new heights, they've got to do some stuff they're uncomfortable with. And this is sort of, I like Bob. He's my buddy. I'm going to keep him. That's what it feels like.
Did you take anything away from any of the comments from Alex Smith to Therese Paylor or at NFL.com about his future and wanting to come back to Kansas City and all the other things he talked about? It seemed pretty standard.
Yeah, it did. Like, what I took from that was, I think Alex, you know, we talk about, like, smart athletes. Alex is not, like, athlete smart. He is, he's a brilliant human being, and I think that he's really articulate and chooses his words perfectly. And what I took from that was he would love to come back, but he understands that that's very unlikely. That's what I took from it, that he understands. He kept saying it's a business. I get it. You know, it's out of my hands. That's what I think that he expects. I think if he went out for a beer with his brother, with some buddies, at the Pro Bowl, then I think he's talking about, you know, God, I wonder if Buffalo is a spot for me. I wonder if Jacksonville is a spot for me. I think that's the conversation that he's having.
Sam Mellinger.
One more thing. He was in a very similar situation 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever, with the 49ers.
Right.
And in hindsight, like after he had been traded, he admitted that he was talking with friends about like where he could land. You know, after he was benched, after Kaepernick was the guy and he knew he was going to get traded, he was talking openly with his friends about, what would be a good spot for him. And he talked about the Chiefs and a couple other teams, but primarily about the Chiefs. And I think he's having those same conversations right now.
Sam Mellinger is in studio. When we come back, Sam will break down the Sunflower Showdown right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, the Sunflower Showdown.
Kansas. Kansas State.
We are talking about K-State.
All right, the Sunflower Showdown.
I would anticipate the same thing that we anticipate every time we go to Manhattan. You know, it'll be the best environment that we'll play in this year from a competitive standpoint. I mean, we won't go to a place that will rival the energy that they have for us anywhere else that they would have for us, even though we played in front of some great home courts. But, you know, there's a little venom and hatred in this one. So I they got a lot to play for as well, and they're playing great. So I think it'll be the toughest atmosphere we've played in this year.
You know, protect home court, just a lot of reasons. That's why I thought it was so big. And I did not want a disappointment going into Kansas. I wanted, you know, to feel good. And I like how we knew we had to fight. We had to scrimp and scrape to, you know, find a way to win. We need that mentality against Kansas. That's got to be a difference maker here at home.
We are trying to scrimp and scrape a show today through this show. Jay's scrimping, I'm scraping.
Right,
but
I'm scrimping.
We have Sam Mellinger to talk about the Sunflower Showdown.
What? Why don't we
ask Fran Fraschilla about it?
We're not going to ask Fran Fraschilla about it. We have Sam Mellinger in studio. Thank you.
Boy.
Just saying.
Every opportunity to be a real smartass.
Isn't Sam the one who asked Fran Fraschilla about
it? We're asking Sam. We don't need to ask Fran. How about ask
but isn't
Sam Mellinger
Sam the
about
one who asked
it?
Fran?
But we're
I'll
not asking.
This. Are you sure he says Fran, though? He
didn't. Ask Fran Fraschilla about it.
Oh, yeah, he does.
I owe my last paycheck almost entirely to Fran Fraschilla and Bob Sutton.
Those two guys,
they are keeping me busy.
Okay. I'll ask Sam Mellinger about it.
Yes.
Ask Fran Fraschilla about it.
All right, what do you think? What's going to happen tonight?
I think K-State wins.
Oh, boy, look at Jake's face now. Now you're not laughing, are you? Hmm?
Stupid.
It's probably good for Kansas.
he just said, stupid.
Yeah. I like the way that they're playing, and I think this game means more. I don't know how much that matters, but I think this
SEC,
game
it means more.
That's right.
That's why they beat the Big 12 with a challenge. Oh, means
more. You get a trophy.
This game's all about Dean Wade.
I think that stuff can matter, especially on a home court, and that is a tough place to play, especially when Kansas goes there. That's going to be an angry arena tonight.
It's been tough for them the last 2 years.
Here we go. Looking forward to it. I just like the way that K-State's playing. I think they're finally playing the way that, you know, sort of Bruce Weber's optimistic view of them would be. Like, Barry Brown is just tough. And on both ends of the court, you know, we talk a lot about his offense. He's a really good defender. Dean Wade is looks like a man. Like, he's, you know, sort of grown up. And, you know, I was impressed with him, really impressed with him in the Kansas game at the one at the Fieldhouse. I mean, those are the kinds of situations where in the past, the at least stereotype, if not, you know, actual legitimate scouting report on Wade is that he would shrink in those moments. And now he's just not. He's aggressive. He's confident. He's an impossible matchup one-on-one. You know, too big for your forwards, too quick for your bigs. I like that team. I think it's close to a coin flip game, but this feels like a K-State win to me.
So you were talking earlier about how you hope you're wrong about Bob Sutton.
Yes.
I've been thinking a lot about Bruce Weber, and were K-State fans wrong about him? Because it
seems
like,
really been just thinking about Bruce Weber a lot. Just
I have. Well, because
I like that.
They're 5-3 in the league now. We have to wait and see, I guess, where this thing turns out. But right now, they look like the most likely challenger to Kansas at this point. They were picked to finish in the bottom third, I think, of the league, if I remember correctly. And not all K-State fans, but a huge percentage of K-State fans wanted him out after the season was over last year.
Sure.
And they were livid that they didn't get Brad Underwood. Brad Underwood's Illinois team is 1-8 in the Big Ten right now. Now, look, it's his first year. He's got to put his own players in there and all that. But I'm thinking about K-State.
They were picked 8th in the coaches' poll.
So there you go. And right now, I mean, they got a chance to move into sole possession, well, into a tie for first place with the win tonight.
We are talking about K-State.
With one of their best players injured.
Yeah.
And everybody's coming back next year. I mean, it looks like they have a chance to take a big step forward this year from what they were last year. And if that happens, then they will be expected to take another big step forward next year with this whole team back. Were K-State fans wrong? Those that wanted Bruce Weber out, were they wrong?
I don't know. I always disagreed with, you know, firing Bruce Weber. You understand it. You know, like, I get it. He's so I think I said this on your show, right? That I've never been more frustrated by a coach that I like than Bruce Weber. And it's not just, you know, the occasional complaints about the officials or the schedule or whatever. It's just, you know, there's a way that they play that sometimes it just leaves you wanting a little bit more. But he's always been, I do think that he's been, you know, sort of treated unfairly in some ways. Maybe that's the wrong way to put it. I think he's taken a lot of crap, more crap than he probably deserves is probably the best way to put it. And yeah, I mean, I think that they are playing, you know, this is how he's always envisioned his program to be playing. I want to pump the brakes a little bit on, I don't know that they're solidly in the tournament yet.
Right.
You know, that non-conference schedule, the Georgia win helps, but that non-conference schedule is a joke.
Yeah, let them lose tonight, and then we're having a different conversation tomorrow. And then
it is like it's crazy how thin these margins are, right?
Right.
Because what if the play, the horrendous play at the end of the game at Kansas, but what if that is a bucket? What if that works? What if Brown passes to Wade? And Wade is able to put a move on Azubuike and able to get a bucket at the buzzer. How much different is K-State right now? But if you look at their schedule, you know, after this,
it's rough coming up.
They're at West Virginia on Saturday. They're at Texas. They get Tech at home. They get Oklahoma State on the road. I mean, it's, you know, they've got a tough road ahead of them still just to get into the tournament. But I guess what I'm saying, it's crazy how right now, you can imagine them finishing second in the league, you know, something like 12, 13 wins in the league, something like that. You can imagine that. You can also imagine them bottoming out and, you know, being lucky to scrape together an NIT or something like that. It's just, you know, the margins are really wild right now. Give one thing I want to, like, you have to talk about if you talk about K-State right now is, you know, Cam Stokes going down. That's the kind of thing that in years past has, you know, sort of cratered some seasons. And it kind of takes, if you're around that program, it just seems like it takes some momentum. Like, one thing that I don't think that Bruce is good at is absorbing those, you know, sort of inevitable blows that you get during a season. You know, there tends to be screw us. Like, you know, what else can go wrong? And that happened. And Cartier Jara has come in and played incredibly well. He is every bit as good as we were hearing when he missed last season with it was a knee injury, right, an ACL. Super athletic, great feet, aggressive in all the right ways. I mean, that has been such a pick-me-up for that program. And I think that's the kind of – I guess my point is, in years past, that Stokes injury – you know, they would have lost three of the last four. And now that Stokes injury, they've won four in a row.
So I just had somebody text me that thinks you're crazy, that K-State's not solidly in the tournament right now. They're in second place in the Big 12. Well, just to back Sam up here, Joe Lunardi's last bracketology he released was on January 25th. So this was before the Georgia game, but he had K-State as one of the last four in.
Yeah.
So that's not – you're not solidly in. If bracketology got you as one of the last four in, you're not a lock.
Yeah, they need some good wins. And they've got opportunities. You know, tough schedule, that means you've got opportunities for big wins. But that's – you know, their non-con was so weak that they might need to be better than 10-8 in the league to get in with that with the non-con. Or 10-8 and then you win a couple, you know, in Kansas City in the Big 12 tournament. But they're I feel like they should be in, but they're not solidly in, by according to the people that pay a lot of attention to it.
I don't understand some of these weak non-conference schedules. I said it about TCU, and apparently that's Jamie Dixon's game plan all the time. But they have an upperclassman-laden team.
Yes.
You know, this K-State team's got a whole bunch of juniors on it. They made the tournament last year. You'd think you'd want to at least, I don't know, have a few games that could bolster that resume a little bit. I can understand if you got, well, we got a whole bunch of underclassmen, a whole bunch of players that haven't really experienced any success. So, you know, we want to build confidence in the non-con, but
I
don't understand it.
This is a bad radio response. I agree.
Sweet. I'm going to come up with some more hotter takes to get you to disagree.
You got
to
do better than that. You got to do better than that.
So what about this game from KU's perspective?
Yeah.
They have a chance to keep the separation with the rest of the teams with a win tonight. But if they lose tonight, looks like a free-for-all. Although, I mean, West Virginia blew another big lead at home, and they lost to Kentucky over the weekend. Oklahoma goes to Alabama, and they lose. You know, Texas Tech, they did have an impressive win at South Carolina, but we've seen they've had some issues now. And so, of all those teams, K-State with a win tonight, boy, that they really are the team that's stepping up as the challenger to Kansas. What do you make of Kansas right now as they're clinging to this lead in the Big 12?
I still think that West Virginia is the best of those four teams that are tied for second. I don't think that the difference is significant. It's absolutely factually correct that if KU loses, they are in a tie for first, right? With K-State, and the margin there would be, I'm trying to do the math here. Would it be a half a game ahead of the others? I think a half a game ahead of the others. But I still, it's just still hard for me to picture KU not at least getting a share of the league title. But that doesn't mean. That has nothing to do with this game from KU's perspective, because I think this game from KU's perspective, you know, that clip that you played of Bill Self talking about, you know, the atmosphere, the way that K-State's playing, all that stuff, he's going to use that. This is a game that, you know, Bill Snyder has always been really good at beating KU and not just beating KU, but it seems like usually covering against KU. He knows what that game means to his fan base. And I think Bill Self has done kind of the same thing with K-State. And I absolutely think that he treats this game different than he does the other other conference games. And I think some of that is some of that is Bruce Weber. You know, I think some of that is you know, personal feelings about Bruce Weber. And I think a lot of it is personal feelings about how the, you know, his fans, the boosters, you know, look at this game. So there, I think KU, as much as K-State's playing really well, I think KU is going to give its best effort as well. I think they're going to be that. That's not a team that, that sort of crumbles under pressure. You know, that's not a team that gets rattled, really by raucous, you know, road atmospheres. You know, you saw that West Virginia, Oklahoma, that was a loud atmosphere, and they controlled that second half, you know, until the Polkadot or whatever. So
what happens tonight if it's close? Will we see Polkadot, and will Doak still be in the game?
You better see it. I don't know how you wouldn't at least try it. And look, like Oklahoma had some advantages there, because they were at six fouls, you know, when they started that. So it was, you know, you're just giving them one on one, not two shots. They had a guy that they just brought. It's incredible. That kid, Matt Freeman, fouled out in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And absolutely did his job and helped his team win. I don't know if I've ever seen that before. I absolutely think that they better, you better use it. You absolutely better. And for Bill Self, I don't know how you leave him on the court. I understand, like, there's an argument to be made about him playing the long game with this and trying to build up some confidence. But I happen to be sitting sort of basically behind KU's bench in Norman, and Doak had like just an empty look. I mean, the body language was broken, and I don't know how you're building confidence by letting a guy go, you know, 0-for-6 or whatever it was in the last 3 minutes from the free throw line.
Sam Mellinger is in studio. We'll take a break and wrap things up with Sam after this on WHB. Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB Sunflower Showdown. Don't forget, Big Monday with Danny Klingscale starts at 6 right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Then Kansas pregame game tips off at 8, followed by Kansas postgame right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, the Sunflower Showdown.
Missouri lost over the weekend again to Mississippi State. Neither team was involved in the Big 12 SEC Challenge, and so Mississippi State beats Missouri 74-62. But we also find out Terrence Phillips has been suspended from the team and is being investigated by university officials. The University of Missouri's Title IX office that investigates allegations of sexual discrimination and violence said in an email that it is investigating Phillips. Both the Kansas City Star and St. Louis Post-Dispatch obtained a copy of the email. The newspapers reported that the Title IX email was sent Friday to an alleged victim. Terrence Phillips, of course, started most of the time under Kim Anderson and has not played very much under Konzo Martin. But from a basketball point of view, he doesn't play very much. The team's struggling anyway, but they have a very, very thin bench, even thinner now without Terrence Phillips. But look, he's being investigated. They have no choice but to suspend him. And it seems like, from what most people are saying, he will not be back on this basketball team.
Yeah, I mean, this probably isn't the direction that you want or expect this answer to go. But with Michigan State, with so many other things going on, maybe this is like getting credit for what you're supposed to do. But good on Missouri for, presumably, from what we know, jumping on this right away, right? And you know, trying to get, not ahead of it, but, you know, meeting this head on. And as we've seen, and again, not just Michigan State, but a lot of places, that doesn't always happen. And, you know, if nothing else, that's just always been my hope that, you know, with some of this Me Too stuff and you know, more allegations and more, you know, sort of institutional misconduct being uncovered, that this is the trend of the future of institutions, of universities, of businesses, of industries, whatever, you know, kind of meeting this stuff head on. Again, it's not probably the... Do you want to talk about basketball, about the basketball implications of it?
Boy, did you you mentioned Michigan State. Did you watch the post-game press conference with Tom Izzo after the Michigan State-Maryland game?
I read it. I did not watch it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Unbelievably uncomfortable. And it great job by the reporter asking the questions.
Yep.
But he wanted no part of it, and he looked like a guy that's
yep.
His job may be in the balance.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess that is a lot of what, you know, is in my head, and I'm sure a lot of other people's head, you know, with the Missouri stuff, is that is an example of, you know, if not cover-ups, certainly, you know, kind of hoping things go away, and things that just aren't, you know, aren't functionally going to go away. Can I say something else too about that press conference? This is a little bit of like inside journalism that probably a lot of people don't care about. But I like that the other reporters in that room kind of let that happen. You know, let that line of questioning go. A lot of times there will be, you know, sort of a plant in
right.
there.
State run media.
Right. Someone on the team's payroll, the school's payroll that will,
You know, hey, Tom, can you talk about Miles Bridges?
Right. Tom, what's your defensive philosophy in games like this?
So, you know, good on the other reporters in the room for kind of letting that go, letting that grow.
Well, and a lot of times the coaches will like to say things like, this isn't the time or place. I'm here to talk about today's game. Well, when is the time or place that we get to talk to you about this stuff?
Yep.
You know, because a lot of times those things happen and then there is no other media availability. So, you know, we're going to come find you. We can find you. And it sounds like Michigan State put up a whole lot of resistance to all the information that ESPN was trying to gather on it. So,
Yep.
And your official prediction for tonight is Kansas State?
Yeah, let's go K-State by 3. 77-74 if you must have a score.
We also need a Super Bowl score. Boy, Jake didn't like that one.
No, he didn't.
What's the score of the Super Bowl going
to
be?
Like something annoying, like 31-14 Patriots.
Oh, no good. Yeah. Not a good game.
I don't. Sick of the Patriots.
Look at Jake. Jake, I don't think Jake liked either one of your predictions.
Well, because the Patriots never play an exciting Super Bowl.
Wow.
That's right. When have they ever played a Super Bowl with your time?
I don't know.
We might have a little discussion with Jake after this. I don't think he liked either one of them.
Was that a Nick Foles reaction?
Is that what that was?
Yeah. That's exactly what that is.
Yep.
Right.
Don't hate on my guy.
I mean this sincerely. Like, I admire and respect and enjoy your love for Nick Foles.
I love the guy.
Finally, my producer has been on a wild 3-year campaign to get you to come to the Kansas City Chiefs.
Great.
He's probably your biggest fan, so he's very excited. A week-long celebration. Could you give a shout-out to Jake, who is very excited to have Nick Foles in a Chiefs uniform?
Jake, it means the world to me that you felt that of me, and I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to meet you in person.
It's just so improbable.
The week is here.
I'm not even sure it's happening. It's just so unlikely that this is that he was even playing, and that they won two playoff games, and they won the championship game, and he put up the best numbers maybe I've ever seen in a championship. I don't know what that's going on.
I mean, I'm genuinely happy for you, Jake.
Thanks, buddy.
We'll be right back after this on WHB.